36. I blinked and opened my eyes, disoriented for a second, as I looked around the immense, dark space of St. Peter's Basilica. Pacem, Monsignor Edouard and Father Paul Duret leaned forward in the dim candlelight, their expressions intense. How long was I asleep? I felt as if only seconds had elapsed. The dream, a shimmer of images one has in the instance between lying peacefully and full sleep. 10 minutes, said the Monsignor. Can you tell us what you saw? I saw no reason not to. When I was finished describing the images, Monsignor Edouard crossed himself. Mon Dieu, the ambassador from the Techno Corps urges Gladstone to send people to those tunnels. Duret touched my shoulder.
After I talk to the true voice of the World Tree on God's Grove, I will join you on TC Squared. We have to tell Gladstone the folly of such a choice.
I nodded. All thoughts of my going to God's Grove with Duret or to Hyperion itself had fled. I agree. We should depart at once. Can the Pope's door take me to Tau Ceti Center? The Monsignor stood, nodded, stretched. Suddenly I realized that he was a very old man, untouched by Poulsen treatments. It has a priority access, he said. He turned to Duret. Paul, you know that I would accompany you if I could. The funeral of His Holiness, the election of a new Holy Father. Monsignor Edouard made a small, rueful sound. Odd how the daily imperatives persist, even in the face of collective disaster. Pacem itself has fewer than 10 standard days until the barbarians arrive. Duret's high forehead gleamed in the candlelight.
The business of the church is something beyond a mere daily imperative, my friend. I will make my visit on the Templar world brief, then join M. Severn in his effort of convincing the CEO not to listen to the Corps. Then I will return, Edouard, and we will try to make some sense of this confused heresy.
I followed the two of them out of the basilica, through a side door that led to a passageway behind the tall colonnades, left across an open courtyard. The rain had stopped and the air smelled fresh, down a stairway and through a narrow tunnel into the papal apartments. Members of the Swiss Guard snapped to attention as we came into the apartment's anteroom. The tall men were dressed in armor and yellow and blue striped pantaloons, although their ceremonial halberds were also force-quality energy weapons. One stepped forward and spoke softly to the Monsignor.
Someone has just arrived at the main terminex to see you, M. Severn.
Me? I had been listening to other voices in other rooms, the melodious rise and fall of oft-repeated prayers. I assumed it had to do with preparation for the Pope's burial.
Yes, an M. Hunt. He says that it is urgent.
Another minute and I would have seen him at Government House, I said. Why not have him join us here? Monsignor Edouard nodded and spoke softly to the Swiss guard, who whispered into an ornamental crest on his antique armor. The so-called Pope's Door, a small farcaster portal surrounded by intricate gold carvings of seraphim and cherubim, topped with a 5-station bas-relief illustrating Adam and Eve's fall from grace and expulsion from the garden, stood in the center of a well-guarded room just off the Pope's private apartments. We waited there, our reflections wan and tired-looking, in the mirrors on each wall. Lee Hunt was escorted in by the priest who had led me to the basilica.
Severn, cried Gladstone's favorite advisor. The CEO needs you at once.
I was just going there, I said. It would be a criminal mistake if Gladstone allowed the Corps to build and use the death device. Hunt blinked, an almost comical reaction on that basset hound countenance.
Do you know everything that happens, Severn?
I had to laugh. A young child sitting unattended in a hollow pit sees much and understands very little. Still, he has the advantage of being able to change channels and turn the thing off when he grows tired of it.
Hunt knew Monsignor Edouard from various state functions, and I introduced Father Paul Doré of the Society of Jesus.
"Doré?"
managed Hunt, his jaw almost hanging slack. It was the first time that I had seen the adviser at a loss for words, and I rather enjoyed the sight. "We'll explain later," I said, and shook the priest's hand. "Good luck on God's Grove, Doré. Don't be too long."
"An hour," promised the Jesuit. "No longer. There is merely one piece of the puzzle I must find before speaking to the CEO. Please explain to her about the horror of the labyrinth. I will give her my own testimony later."
"It's possible that she'll be too busy to see me before you get there anyway," I said. "But I'll do my best to play John the Baptist for you." Doré smiled.
"Just don't lose your head, my friend."
He nodded, tapped in a transfer code on the archaic disk-key panel, and disappeared through the portal. I bid farewell to Monsignor Edouard. "We will get all this settled before the ouster wave gets this far." The old priest raised a hand and blessed me. "Go with God, young man. I feel that dark times await us all, but that you will be especially burdened." I shook my head. "I'm just an observer, Monsignor. I wait and watch and dream. Little burden there."
"Wait and watch and dream later," Lee Hunt said sharply. "Herr Nibs wants you within reach now, and I have a meeting to get back to."
I looked at the little man. "How did you find me?" I asked needlessly. Farcasters were operated by the Corps, and the Corps worked with the hegemony authorities.
"The override card she gave you also makes it easier to keep track of your travels," Hunt said, his impatience audible. "Right now we have an obligation to be where things are happening."
"Very well." I nodded at the Monsignor and his aide, beckoned to Hunt and tapped in the 3-digit code for Tau Ceti Center, added 2 digits for the continent, 3 more for Government House, and added the final 2 numbers for the private Terminex there. The forecaster's hum went up a notch on the scale. Its opaque surface seemed to shimmer with expectancy. I stepped through first, stepped aside to give Hunt room as he followed. "We are not in the Central Government House Terminex. As far as I can tell, we are nowhere near Government House." A second later, my senses total the input of sunlight, sky color, gravity, distance to horizon, smells, and feel of things, and decide that we aren't on Tau Ceti Center. I would have jumped back through the portal then, but the Pope's door is small. Hunt is coming through, leg, arm, shoulder, chest, head, second leg appearing. So I grab his wrist, pull him through roughly, say, "Something's wrong," and try to step back through. But too late. The frameless portal on this side shimmers, dilates to a circle the size of my fist, and is gone.
"Where the hell are we?"
demands Hunt. I look around and think, "Good question." "We are in the country on a hilltop. A road underfoot winds through vineyards, goes down a long hill through a wooded vale, and disappears around another hill 1 mile or 2 distant. It is very warm, and the air hums with the sounds of insects, but nothing larger than a bird moves in this vast panorama. Between bluffs to our right, a blue smear of water is visible, either an ocean or sea. High cirrus ripples overhead. The sun is just past the zenith. I see no houses, no technology more complicated than the vineyard rows and the stone and mud road underfoot. More importantly, the constant background buzz of the datasphere is gone. It is somewhat like suddenly hearing the absence of a sound one has been immersed in since infancy. It is startling, heart-stopping, confusing, and a bit terrifying." Hunt staggers, claps his ears as if it is true sound he is missing, taps at his comm log.
"God damn," he mutters. "God damn, my implant's malfunctioning. Comm log's out."
"No," I say. "I believe we're beyond the datasphere." But even as I say this, I hear a deeper, softer hum, something far greater and far less accessible than the datasphere. The megasphere?
the music of the spheres, I think, and smile.
What the hell are you grinning about, Severn? Did you do this on purpose?
No. I gave the proper codes for Government House. The total absence of panic in my voice is a kind of panic itself.
What is it, then? That goddamned Pope's door? Did it do this, some mouth or trick?
No, I think not. The door didn't malfunction, Hunt. It brought us just where the Techno Corps wants us.
The Corps?
What little color left in that Bassett countenance quickly drains away as the CEO's aide realizes who controls the Farcaster, who controls all Farcasters.
My God. My God.
Hunt staggers to the side of the road and sits in the tall grass there. His suede executive suit and soft black shoes look out of place here.
Where are we?
He asks again. I take a deep breath. The air smells of fresh-turned soil, newly mown grass, road dust, and the sharp tinge of the sea. My guess is that we're on Earth, Hunt.
Earth.
The little man is staring straight ahead, focusing on nothing.
Earth. Not New Earth. Not Terra. Not Earth 2. Not...
No, I say. Earth. Old Earth. Or its duplicate.
Its duplicate.
I go over and sit beside him. I pull a strand of grass and strip the lower part of its outer sheath. The grass tastes tart and familiar. You remember my report to Gladstone on the Hyperion Pilgrim stories? Braun Lamia's tale? She and my cybrid counterpart, the first Keats retrieval persona, traveled to what they thought was an old Earth duplicate. In the Hercules cluster, if I remember correctly. Hunt glances up as if he can judge what I am saying by checking constellations. The blue above is graying slightly, as the high Cirrus spreads across the dome of sky.
Hercules cluster, he whispers.
Why the Techno Corps built a duplicate, or what they're doing with it now, Braun didn't learn, I say. Either the first Keats hybrid didn't know, or he wasn't saying.
Wasn't saying,
nods Hunt. He shakes his head.
All right. How the hell do we get out of here? Gladstone needs me. She can't... There are dozens of vital decisions to be made in the next few hours.
He jumps to his feet, runs to the center of the road, a study in purposeful energy. I chew on the stalk of grass. My guess is that we don't get out of here. Hunt comes at me as if he is going to assault me then and there.
Are you insane? No way out? That's nuts. Why would the Corps do that?
He pauses, looks down at me.
They don't want you talking to her. You know something that the Corps can't risk her learning.
Perhaps.
Leave him! Let me go back!
He screams at the sky. No one answers. Far out across the vineyard, a large black bird takes flight. I think it is a crow. I remember the name of the extinct species as if from a dream. After a moment, Hunt gives up on addressing the sky and paces back and forth on the stone road.
Come on. Maybe there's a Terminex wherever this thing goes.
Perhaps, I say, breaking off the stalk of grass to get at the sweet, dry upper half.
But which way?
Hunt turns, looks at the road disappearing around hills in both directions, turns again.
We came through the portal looking. This way.
He points. The road goes downhill into a narrow wood. How far? I ask.
God damn it, does it matter? He barks. We have to get somewhere.
I resist the impulse to smile. All right. I stand and brush off my trousers, feeling the fierce sunlight on my forehead and face. After the incense-laden darkness of the basilica, it is a shock. The air is very hot, and my clothing is already damp with sweat. Hunt starts walking vigorously down the hill, his fists clenched, his doleful expression ameliorated for once by a stronger expression, sheer resolve. Walking slowly, in no hurry, still chewing on my stalk of sweet grass, eyes half closed with weariness, I follow him. Colonel Fedmon Kassad screamed and attacked the shrike. The surreal out-of-time landscape, a minimalist stage designer's version of the Valley of the Time Tombs, molded in plastic and set in a gel of viscous air, seemed to vibrate to the violence of Kassad's rush. For an instant there had been a mirror image scattering of shrikes, shrikes throughout the valley, spread across the barren plain. But with Kassad's shout these resolved themselves to the single monster. And now it moved, four arms unfolding and extending, curving to greet the colonel's rush with a hearty hug of blades and thorns. Kassad did not know if the energy skin suit he wore, Moneta's gift, would protect him or serve him well in combat. It had years before, when he and Moneta had attacked two dropships worth of ouster commandos. But time had been on their side then. The shrike had frozen and unfrozen the flow of moments, like a bored observer playing with a hollow pit remote control. Now they were outside time, and the shrike was the enemy, not some terrible patron. Kassad shouted and put his head down and attacked, no longer aware of Moneta watching, nor of the impossible tree of thorns rising into the clouds with its terrible, impaled audience, nor even aware of himself except as a fighting tool, an instrument of revenge. The shrike did not disappear in its usual manner, did not cease being there to suddenly be here. Instead it crouched and opened its arms wider. Its finger blades caught the light of the violent sky. The shrike's metal teeth glistened in what might have been a smile. Kassad was angry. He was not insane. Rather than rush into that embrace of death, he threw himself aside at the last instant, rolling on arm and shoulder and kicking out at the monster's lower leg, below the cluster of thorn blades at the knee joint, above a similar array on the ankle. If he could get it down... It was like kicking at a pipe embedded in half a click of concrete. The blow would have broken Kassad's own leg if the skin suit had not acted as armor and shock absorber. The shrike moved, quickly but not impossibly. The two right arms swinging up and down and around in a blur, 10 finger blades carving soil and stone in surgical furrows, arm thorns sending sparks flying as the hands continued upward, slicing air with an audible rush. Kassad was out of range, continuing his roll, coming to his feet again, crouching, his own arms tensed, palms flat, energy-suited fingers rigid and extended.
"Single combat," thought Fedmon Kassad. "The most honorable sacrament in the new Bushido."
The shrike feinted with its right arms again, swung the lower left arm around and up with a sweeping blow, violent enough to shatter Kassad's ribs and scoop his heart out. Kassad blocked the right arm feint with his left forearm, feeling the skin suit flex and batter bone as the steel and axe force of the shrike's blow struck home. The left arm killing blow he stopped with his right hand on the monster's wrist, just above the corsage of curved spikes there. Incredibly, he slowed the blow's momentum enough that scalpel-sharp finger blades were now scraping against his skin-suit field rather than splintering ribs. Kassad was almost lifted off the ground with the effort of restraining that rising claw. Only the downward thrust of the shrike's first feint kept the colonel from flying backward. Sweat poured freely under the skin-suit. Muscles flexed and ached and threatened to rip in that interminable 20 seconds of struggle before the shrike brought its fourth arm into play, slashing downward at Kassad's straining leg. Kassad screamed as the skin suit field ripped, flesh tore, and at least one finger blade sliced close to bone. He kicked out with his other leg, released the thing's wrist, and rolled frantically away. The shrike swung twice, the second blow whistling millimeters from Kassad's moving ear, but then jumped back itself, crouching, moving to its right. Kassad got to his left knee, almost fell, then staggered to his feet, hopping slightly to keep his balance. The pain roared in his ears and filled the universe with red light, but even as he grimaced and staggered, close to fainting from the shock of it,
He could feel the skin suit closing on the wound, serving as both tourniquet and compress. He could feel the blood on his lower leg, but it was no longer flowing freely, and the pain was manageable, almost as if the skin suit carried medpack injectors like his force battle armor. The shrike rushed him. Kassat kicked once, twice, aiming for and finding the smooth bit of chrome carapace beneath the chest spike. It was like kicking the hull of a torch ship, but the shrike seemed to pause, stagger, step back. Kassad stepped forward, planted his weight, struck twice where the creature's heart should be with a closed fist blow that would have shattered tempered ceramic, ignored the pain from his fist, swiveled and slammed a straight-armed, open-palmed blow into the creature's muzzle just above the teeth. Any human being would have heard the sound of his nose being broken and felt the explosion of bone and cartilage being driven into his brain. The shrike snapped at Kassad's wrist, missed, swung four hands at Kassad's head and shoulders. Panting, pouring sweat and blood under his quicksilver armor, Kassad spun to his right once, twice, and came around with a killing blow to the back of the creature's short neck. The noise of the impact echoed in the frozen valley like the sound of an axe thrown from miles on high into the heart of a metal redwood. The shrike tumbled forward, rolled onto its back like some steel crustacean. It had gone down. Kassad stepped forward, still crouched, still cautious, but not cautious enough as the shrike's armored foot, claw, whatever the hell it was, caught the back of Kassad's ankle and half-sliced, half-kicked him off his feet. Kassad felt the pain, knew that his Achilles tendon had been severed, tried to roll away, but the creature was throwing itself up and sideways on him, spikes and thorns and blades coming at Kassad's ribs and face and eyes. Grimacing with the pain, arching in a vain attempt to throw the monster off, Kassad blocked some blows, saved his eyes, and felt other blades slam home in his upper arms, chest, and belly. The shrike hovered closer and opened its mouth. Kassad stared up into row upon row of steel teeth set in a metal lamprey's hollow orifice of a mouth. Red eyes filled his sight through vision already tinged with blood. Kassad got the base of his palm under the shrike's jaw and tried to find leverage. It was like trying to lift a mountain of sharp scrap with no fulcrum. The shrike's finger blades continued to tear at Kassad's flesh. The thing opened its mouth and tilted its head until teeth filled Kassad's field of vision from ear to ear. The monster had no breath, but the heat from its interior stank of sulfur and heated iron filings. Kassad had no defense left. When the thing snapped its jaws shut, it would take the flesh and skin of Kassad's face off to the bone. Suddenly, Moneta was there, shouting in that place where sound did not carry, grabbing the shrike by its ruby-faceted eyes, skin-suited fingers arching like talons, her boot planted firmly on its carapace below the backspike, pulling, pulling. The shrike's arms snapped backward, as double-jointed as some nightmare crab. Finger blades raked Moneta and she fell away, but not before Kassad rolled, scrambled, felt the pain but ignored it, and leaped to his feet, dragging Moneta with him as he retreated across the sand and frozen rock. For a second, their skin suits merged, as it had when they were making love, and Kassad felt her flesh next to his. Felt their blood and sweat mingling, and heard the joined poundings of their hearts. "Kill it," Moneta whispered urgently, pain audible even through that subvocal medium.
"I'm trying. I'm trying."
The shrike was on its feet, 3 meters of chrome and blades and other people's pain. It showed no damage. Someone's blood ran in narrow rivulets down its wrists and carapace. Its mindless grin seemed wider than before. Kassad separated his skin suit from Moneta's, lowered her gently to a boulder, although he sensed that he had been hurt worse than she. This was not her fight, not yet. He moved between his love and the shrike. Kassad hesitated, hearing a faint but rising susurration, as if from a rising surf on an invisible shore.
He glanced up, never fully removing his gaze from the slowly advancing shrike, and realized that it was a shouting from the thorn tree, far behind the monster. The crucified people there, small dabs of color hanging from the metal thorns and cold branches, were making some noise other than the subliminal moans of pain Kassad had heard earlier. They were cheering. Kassad returned his attention to the shrike as the thing began to circle again. Kassad felt the pain and weakness in his almost severed heel. His right foot was useless, unable to bear weight, and he half-hopped, half-swiveled with one hand on the boulder to keep his body between the shrike and Moneta. The distant cheering seemed to stop, as if in a gasp. The shrike ceased being there, and came into existence here. Next to Kassad, on top of Kassad, its arms already around him in a terminal hug, thorns and blades already impinging. The shrike's eyes blazed with light, its jaws opened again. Kassad shouted in pure rage and defiance and struck at it. Father Paul Duret stepped through the Pope's door to God's Grove without incident. From the incense-laden dimness of the papal apartments, he suddenly found himself in rich sunlight, with a lemon sky above and green leaves all around. The Templars were waiting as he stepped down from the private Farcaster portal. Doré could see the edge of the weirwood platform 5 meters to his right, and beyond it, nothing, or rather everything, as the treetop world of God's Grove stretched great distances to the horizon, the rooftop of leaves shimmering and moving like a living ocean. Duray knew that he was high on the world tree, the greatest and holiest of all the trees the Templars held sacred. The Templars greeting him were important in the complicated hierarchy of the Brotherhood of the Muir, but served as mere guides now, leading him from the portal platform to a vine-strewn elevator, which rose through upper levels and terraces where few non-Templars had ever ascended, and then out again and up along a staircase bound by a railing of the finest muir wood, spiraling skyward around a trunk that narrowed from its 200-meter base to less than 8 meters across here near its top. The weirwood platform was exquisitely carved. Its railings showed a delicate tracery of hand-carved vines. Posts and balusters boasted the faces of gnomes, wood sprites, fairies, and other spirits. And the table and chairs which Duray now approached were carved from the same piece of wood as the circular platform itself. 2 men awaited him. The first was the one Duray expected. True voice of the World Tree, High Priest of the Muir, spokesman of the Templar Brotherhood, Sekhardin. The second man was a surprise. Doré noted the red robe, a red the color of arterial blood, with black ermine trim, the heavy Lusian body covered by that robe, the face all jowls and fat, bisected by a formidable beak of a nose, 2 tiny eyes lost above fat cheeks, 2 pudgy hands with a black or red ring on each finger. Duray knew that he was looking at the bishop of the Church of the Final Atonement, the high priest of the shrike cult. The Templar rose to his almost 2-meter height and offered his hand. "Father Duray, we are most pleased that you could join us." Duray shook hands, thinking as he did so much how like a root the Templar's hand was, with its long, tapering, yellowish-brown fingers. The true voice of the World Tree wore the same hooded robe that Het Mastin had worn, its rough brown and green threads in sharp contrast to the brilliance of the bishop's garb.
"Thank you for seeing me on such short notice, M. Hardin," said Duray.
The true voice was the spiritual leader of millions of the followers of the Muir. But Duray knew that Templars disliked titles or honorifics in conversation. Duray nodded in the direction of the bishop.
"Your Excellency, I had no idea that I would have the honor of being in your presence."
The shrike cult bishop nodded almost imperceptibly.
"I was visiting. M. Hardin suggested that it might be of some small benefit if I attended this meeting.
I am pleased to meet you, Father Duray. We have heard much about you in the past few years.
The Templar gestured toward a seat across the muirwood table from the two of them, and Duray sat, folding his hands on the polished tabletop, thinking furiously even as he pretended to inspect the beautiful grain in the wood. Half the security forces in the web were searching for the Shrike cult bishop. His presence suggested complications far beyond those the Jesuit had been prepared to deal with.
"Interesting, is it not?" said the bishop, "that three of humankind's most profound religions are represented here today?"
"Yes," said Duray. "Profound, but hardly representational of the beliefs of the majority. Out of almost 150 billion souls, the Catholic Church claims fewer than a million. The Church of the Final Atonement, perhaps 5 to 10 million. And how many Templars are there, M. Hardeen?"
23 million, the Templar said softly. "Many others supported our ecological causes and might even wish to join, but the Brotherhood is not open to outsiders."
The bishop rubbed one of his chins. His skin was very pale, and he squinted as if he were not used to daylight.
"The Zen Gnostics claim 40 billion followers," he rumbled. "But what kind of religion is that, eh? No churches, no priests, no holy books, no concept of sin?"
Duray smiled.
"It seems to be the belief most attuned to the times, and has been for many generations now."
"Bah!" The bishop slapped his hand down on the table, and Duray winced as he heard the metal of the rings strike Muirwood.
"How is it that you know who I am?" asked Paul Duray.
The Templar lifted his head just enough that Duray could see sunlight on his nose, cheeks, and the long line of chin within the shadows of the cowl. He did not speak.
"We chose you," growled the bishop. "You and the other pilgrims."
"You being the Shrike Church?" said Duray.
The bishop frowned at that phrase, but nodded without speaking.
"Why the riots?"
asked Duray.
"Why the disturbances now that the hegemony is threatened?"
When the bishop rubbed his chin, red and black stones glinted in the evening light. Beyond him, a million leaves rustled in a breeze which brought the scent of rain-moistened vegetation.
"The final days are here, priest. The prophecies given to us by the Avatar centuries ago are unfolding before our eyes. What you call riots are the first death throes of a society which deserves to die. The days of atonement are upon us, and the Lord of Pain soon will walk among us."
"The Lord of Pain," repeated Duray. "The Shrike."
The Templar made an ameliorating gesture with one hand, as if he were trying to take some of the edge off the bishop's statement.
"Father Duray, we are aware of your miraculous rebirth."
"Not a miracle," said Duray. "The whim of a parasite called a cruciform."
Again the gesture with the long yellow-brown fingers.
"However you see it, Father, the Brotherhood rejoices that you are with us once again. Please go ahead with the query you mentioned when you called earlier."
Duray rubbed his palms against the wood of the chair, glanced at the bishop sitting across from him in all of his red and black bulk.
"Your groups have been working together for some time, haven't they?" said Duray. "The Templar Brotherhood and the Shrike Church."
"Church of the Final Atonement,"
the bishop said in a bass growl. Duray nodded.
"Why? What brings you together in this?"
The true voice of the World Tree leaned forward so that shadow filled his cowl once again.
"You must see, Father, that the prophecies of the Church of the Final Atonement touch upon our mission from the Muir. Only these prophecies have held the key to what punishment must befall humankind for killing its own world."
"Humankind alone didn't destroy old Earth," said Duray. "It was a computer error in the Kiev team's attempt to create a mini black hole."
The Templar shook his head.
"It was human arrogance,"
he said softly. The same arrogance which has caused our race to destroy all species that might even hope to evolve to intelligence some day. The Seniskai Alouit on Hebron, the Zeppelins of Whirl, the Marsh Centaurs of Garden, and the great apes of Old Earth.
Yes, said Duray. Mistakes have been made, but that shouldn't sentence humankind to death, should it?
The sentence has been handed down by a power far greater than ourselves, rumbled the bishop. The prophecies are precise and explicit. The day of final atonement must come. All who have inherited the sins of Adam and Kiev must suffer the consequences of murdering their home world, of extinguishing other species. The Lord of Pain has been freed from the bonds of time to render this final judgment. There is no escaping his wrath. There is no avoiding atonement. A power far greater than us has said this.
It is true, said Sekhardine. The prophecies have come to us, spoken to the true voices over the generations. Humankind is doomed, but with their doom will come a new flowering for pristine environments in all parts of what is now the hegemony.
Trained in Jesuit logic, devoted to the evolutionary theology of Teilhard de Chardin, Father Paul Duray was nonetheless tempted to say, But who the hell cares if the flowers bloom if no one is around to see them, to smell them? Instead, he said, Have you considered that these prophecies were not divine revelations, but merely manipulations from some secular power? The Templar sat back as if slapped. But the bishop leaned forward and curled two Lusian fists, which could have crushed Doré's skull with a single blow.
Heresy! Whoever dares deny the truth of the revelations must die!
What power could do this? Managed the true voice of the World Tree. What power other than the Muir's absolute could enter our minds and hearts?
Doré gestured toward the sky.
Every world in the web has been joined through the Technocore's datasphere for generations. Most people of influence carry Comlog extension implants for ease of accessing. Do you not, Emhardine?
The Templar said nothing, but Duray saw the small twitch of fingers, as if the man were going to pat his chest and upper arm where the micro-implants had lain for decades.
The Technocore has created a transcendent intelligence, continued Duray. It taps incredible amounts of energy, is able to move backward and forward in time, and is not motivated by human concerns. One of the goals of a sizable percentage of the core personalities was to eliminate humankind. Indeed, the big mistake of the Kiev team may have been deliberately executed by the AIs involved in that experiment. What you hear as prophecies may be the voice of this Deus Ex Machina whispering through the datasphere. The Shrike may be here not to make humankind atone for its sins, but merely to slaughter human men, women, and children for this machine personality's own goals.
The bishop's heavy face was red as his robe. His fists pummeled the table and he struggled to his feet. The Templar laid a hand on the bishop's arm and restrained him, somehow pulled him back to his seat.
Where have you heard this idea? Sekhardine asked Duray.
From those on the pilgrimage who have access to the core, and from others.
The bishop shook a fist in Duray's direction.
But you yourself have been touched by the Avatar, not once but twice. He has granted you a form of immortality so you can see what he has in store for the chosen people, those who prepare atonement before the final days are upon us.
The Shrike gave me pain, said Duray. Pain and suffering beyond imagination. I have met the thing twice, and I know in my heart that it is neither divine nor diabolical, but merely some organic machine from a terrible future.
Bah!
The bishop made a dismissive gesture, folded his arms, and stared out over the low balcony at nothing. The Templar appeared shaken. After a moment, he raised his head and said softly,
You had a question for me?
Duray took a breath.
I did. And sad news, I'm afraid. True voice of the tree, Het Mastin is dead.
We know, said the Templar. Duret was surprised. He could not imagine how they could receive that information. But it did not matter now.
What I need to know is why did he go on the pilgrimage? What was the mission that he did not live to see completed? Each of us told our story. Hetmestine did not. Yet somehow I feel that his fate held the key to many mysteries.
The bishop looked back at Duret and sneered.
We need tell you nothing, priest of a dead religion.
Sekhardin sat silent a long moment before responding.
Emmastine volunteered to be the one to carry the word of the Muir to Hyperion. The prophecy has lain in the roots of our belief for centuries that when the troubled times came, a true voice of the tree would be called upon to take a tree ship to the holy world, to see it destroyed there, and then to have it reborn carrying the message of atonement and the Muir.
So Hetmestine knew that the tree Yggdrasil would be destroyed in orbit?
Yes, it was foretold.
And he and the single energy binder Erg from the ship were to fly a new tree ship?
Yes, said the Templar almost inaudibly. A tree of atonement, which the Avatar would provide.
Duret sat back, nodded.
A tree of atonement, the thorn tree. Hetmestine was psychically injured when the Yggdrasil was destroyed. Then he was taken to the Valley of the Time Tombs and shown the Shrike's thorn tree. But he was not ready or able to do it. The thorn tree is a structure of death, of suffering, of pain. Hetmestine was not prepared to captain it. Or perhaps he refused. In any case, he fled and died. I thought as much. But I had no idea what fate the Shrike had offered him.
What are you talking about? Snapped the bishop. The Tree of Atonement is described in the prophecies. It will accompany the Avatar in his final harvest. Mastine would have been prepared and honored to captain it through space and time.
Paul Duret shook his head. We have answered your question? Asked M. Hardin.
Yes.
Then you must answer ours, said the bishop. What has happened to the mother?
What mother?
The mother of our salvation, the bride of atonement, the one you called Braun Lamia.
Duret thought back, trying to remember the consul's taped summaries of the tales the pilgrims had told on the way to Hyperion. Braun had been pregnant with the first Keet Cybrid's child. The Shrike Temple on Lucis had saved her from the mob, included her in the pilgrimage. She had said something in her story about the Shrike cultists treating her with reverence. Duret tried to fit all this into the confused mosaic of what he had already learned. He could not. He was too tired. And, he thought, too stupid after this so-called resurrection. He was not and never would be the intellectual Paul Duret once had been.
Braun was unconscious, he said. Evidently taken by the Shrike and attached to some thing, some cable. Her mental state was the equivalent of brain death, but the fetus was alive and healthy.
And the persona she carried? Asked the bishop, his voice tense.
Duret remembered what Severn had told him about the death of that persona in the Megasphere. Evidently these two did not know about the second Keats persona, the Severn personality that at this moment was warning Gladstone about the dangers of the core proposal. Duret shook his head. He was very tired.
I don't know about the persona she carried in the Shrone Loop, he said. The cable, the thing the Shrike attached to her, seemed to plug into the neural socket like a cortical shunt.
The bishop nodded, evidently satisfied.
The prophecies proceed apace. You have served your purpose as messenger, Duret. I must leave now.
The big man stood, nodded toward the true voice of the World Tree, and swept across the platform and down the stairs toward the elevator and Terminex. Duret sat across from the Templar in silence for several minutes. The sound of leaves blowing and the gentle rocking of the treetop platform was marvelously lulling, inviting the Jesuit to doze off. Above them, The sky was fading through delicate saffron shades as the world of God's Grove turned into twilight. Your statement about a deus ex machina misleading us for generations through false prophecies was a terrible heresy, the Templar said at last.
Yes, but terrible heresies have proven to be grim truths many times before, in the longer history of my church, Sekhardin.
If you were a Templar, I could have you put to death, the hooded figure said softly. Dure sighed. At his age, in his situation, and as tired as he was, the thought of death created no fear in his heart. He stood and bowed slightly.
I need to go, Sekhardin. I apologize if anything I said offended you. It is a confused and confusing time. The best lack all conviction, he thought, while the worst are full of passionate intensity.
Dure turned and walked to the edge of the platform and stopped. The staircase was gone. 30 vertical meters and 15 horizontal meters of air separated him from the next lower platform where the elevator waited. The World Tree dropped away a kilometer or more into leafy depths beneath him. Dure and the true voice of that tree were isolated here on the highest platform. Dure walked to a nearby railing, raised his suddenly sweaty face to the evening breeze, and noticed the first of the stars emerging from the ultramarine sky.
What's going on, Sekhardin?
The robed and cowled figure at the table was wrapped in darkness. In 18 minutes standard, the world of Heaven's Gate will fall to the ousters. Our prophecies say that it will be destroyed. Certainly its farcaster will, and its fatline transmitters. And to all intents and purposes that world will have ceased to exist. Precisely 1 standard hour later, the skies of God's Grove will be alight from the fusion fires of ouster warships. Our prophecies say that all of the Brotherhood who remain, and anyone else, although all Hegemony's citizens have long since been evacuated by Farcaster, will perish. Dure walked slowly back to the table.
It's imperative that I cast to Tau Ceti Center, he said. Severn, someone is waiting for me. I have to speak to CEO Gladstone.
No, said True Voice of the World Tree, Sekhardin. We will wait. We will see if the prophecies are correct. The Jesuit clenched his fists in frustration, fighting the surge of violent emotion that made him want to strike the roped figure. Dure closed his eyes and said 2 Hail Marys. It didn't help.
Please, he said, the prophecies will be confirmed or denied, whether I am here or not, and then it will be too late. The 4 torch ships will blow the singularity sphere, and the Farcasters will be gone. We'll be cut off from the web for years. Billions of lives may depend upon my immediate return to Tau Ceti Center.
The Templar folded his arms so that his long-fingered hands disappeared in the folds of his robe. We will wait, he said. All things predicted will come to pass. In minutes, the Lord of Pain will be loosed on those in the web. I do not believe in the bishop's faith that those who have sought atonement will be spared. We are better off here, Father Dure, where the end will be swift and painless. Dure searched his tired mind for something decisive to say, to do. Nothing occurred to him. He sat at the table and stared at the cowled and silent figure across from him. Above them the stars emerged in their fiery multitudes. The world forest of God's Grove rustled a final time to the evening breeze and seemed to hold its breath in anticipation. Paul Dure closed his eyes and prayed.